funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why has the story of Oedipus Rex survived for 2,400 years, and what resonance does it have for modern audiences? In his script for Oedipus El Rey, playwright Luis Alfaro reimagines the king as a young Mexican-American who has come of age within the confines of the California state prison system, where many real-life inmates seem as unable to break the patterns of recidivism and repeated incarcerations as Oedipus is to escape the prophecies that he will kill his father and bed his mother. Oedipus El Rey is running at the Dallas Theater Center through March 2nd, and joining us to discuss the ancient story and its contemporary iterations are David Davies, Assistant Professor of English and Adjunct Professor of Classics at the University of Dallas, along with Kevin Moriarty, who is Artistic Director of the Dallas Theater Center. Welcome to both of you. Great to have you here.
Nice Thank to you. Be here.
What do we know about the origins of the Oedipus myth?
The earliest mention of it is in Homer. It's in the Catalogue of Ships. It's clearly that there were several versions of the story because the one that's mentioned in Homer has the wife of Oedipus. Her name is Epicaste. It's a very brief mention. It's just a notice of it. It is also the case that, we only have seven plays of Sophocles, seven plays of Aeschylus. Until the 19th century, only had seven plays of Euripides, until another 15 or so plays were found in the sands of Egypt in a library. Now, but we know the names of lots of plays from these three playwrights and other playwrights, the names of their plays, and the Oedipus was a frequent story. There's a Euripidean version. I think there's also an Aeschylus version. So it's clearly a story that that was available to the playwrights that they were attracted by. But beyond that, I don't know how much we know.
Why is the Sophocles version the definitive version?
Well, it's the one that we have. That's the simple thing. But it's the more important than that. Aristotle in the Poetics, this little pamphlet, which is so influential in the history of Western literature, in the Poetics, this is his prime example to not simply explain what tragedy is, but to explain what poetry is. Aristotle says it's the most poetic of Sophocles' plays, and it's the most poetic play of all.
There is great poetry in the Luis Alfaro version, and particularly in the beginning when you have this Greek chorus, Kevin, of Latino prison inmates, essentially nameless at the time, speaking from all around the theater, sort of above and behind the audience. Can you talk about that interpretation of the Greek chorus in a really modern way?
Well, I think where Luis started when he set out to create a brand new play inspired by Oedipus Rex, he started by asking questions about the role fate plays in our lives and our world today. And whereas for some in the ancient Greek world, that might have been forces outside of an individual's control, let's say the gods predetermining or controlling your destiny, even though you can't see that control or sense it as you live. For Luis, as he was working in prisons in California while also being a significant poet and playwright, and he began to think that for the prisoners in the contemporary penal system today, that the prison system was functioning similarly to the malevolent forces of these Greek gods, that you are more likely, if you are a man put into jail today, you are more likely to end up back in jail after you're released than you are to be free. That's just statistically true. 53% of the men who are put in jail then return back into jail. So what might seem like you have free will as you step out of the jail and make choices about your own life can actually be social forces at work that you can't see or sense, but that in some way are influencing your destiny. And as he started from that perspective, that led him to think, well, then who is the chorus telling this story and commenting on its action, which led him to think of creating a chorus of prisoners rather than, say, the population as a whole or ancient Greek citizens.
And, of course, we can point the finger at the prison system for these problems, but that's really synecdoche for the rest of society, right? We're all there.
Well, yes. And what's fascinating to me about the play is that not only is there a social political dimension that's controlling the characters' lives, the prison system being one, but there's multiple forces that are at play. And to untangle one leads invariably to the others, that people's destinies and their fates are influenced deeply by their religious beliefs and the limitations that that sometimes places on them, influenced by our own desire, often unspoken or unknowable desires that we have inside of ourselves. This is a way Freud would have read Oedipus, of course, can then lead to choices and actions, maybe even an unconscious level that you're not aware are controlling you. So whether that's what we think of today, I guess, as psychology or sociology or economic and political systems, there are ways in which as people we may feel free and yet have significant predetermined limitations on the amount of choices or the final destination we'll arrive at in our lives.
David, for people who haven't interacted with the work before or haven't read it in some time, can you give us just a sort of a brief summary of the story that is told here?
Okay. In the classical play, because of the way Aristotle describes this in the Poetics, and he's our best authority on what the shape of the play is, one of the most important elements to Aristotle, which seems insignificant to us, is that the action take place in a single day. Now, the reason why that's necessary is because it establishes a kind of base-level unity. If you think about your own individual days, usually there is something that unifies them. There's something you're doing on any particular day that everything else in your day is somehow related to. That the playwrights use that as a way of producing unity because you must have something to understand that's a whole. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the crucial elements. Okay, as the play is constructed out of things that we would find are probable, no sense that violates the audience's expectations. What will happen in the play as a whole is that we will come to see that those things are not just probable, they're necessary that they happen. That brings up the issue of relation of fate or what we mean by fate. Okay, but you ask about what's the substance of the play. There is this man, Oedipus, who in the Sophocles play opens, he's addressing the citizens of his own of the city that he rules, who have come to him because there's a plague, and they want him to solve the plague. Now, what has happened is that he has become king because he was capable of ridding this city, Thebes, from the curse of the Sphinx, which was causing all kinds of problems. But he solves the riddle of the Sphinx, and so therefore, since this city that he arrives at has a queen, but the king has mysteriously disappeared and is thought to have
missing
been lost.
And presumed dead. Yes.
Missing and presumed dead. He has been appointed. He is offered the kingship because he solves the riddle. Now, none of these things take place during the action of the play that mm-hmm. we see, but they're things that we learn through various speeches. Okay. Now, in the play itself, it's a gradual struggle or Oedipus's desire, given his confidence in his intellectual powers, that he will solve, he will figure out what is the cause of the pollution that is troubling people. Well, he's already sent a messenger to the oracle at Delphi and has been told that there's this pollution. But what he discovers when it comes back is that he suspects that the report that Creon, who is Jocasta's brother. Mm-hmm.
Jocasta is the queen.
And he suspects that there's a plot going on, given the extent to which the oracle has suggested that the cause of the plague is in the city. Oedipus takes offense, of course, that he would be have allowed such a thing to take place. And what gradually happens in the rest of the play is the unraveling of his own desire, first to discover what is the source of the plague, but then it turns to a different question, which as it becomes more, he becomes aware that his own strange past history is involved in this play, he becomes more interested in his own origins. And it's the question of his questing after his own origins and discovering that the two things are intimately connected is the driving engine of the plot.
I'm comfortable with spoilers here because the text is the source text is 2,400 years old. But some of the things that transpire is that Oedipus learns that there have been these prophecies that he would kill his own father and sleep with his own mother. And so those are sort of the big dramatic moments. And what is so heartbreaking, and I guess has been all along, because even ancient audiences sort of knew what the ending was before they walked in, is that these things have already taken place when Oedipus learns what has been prophesied for him.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me that the characters in the play are desperately trying to prevent these awful things from happening in order to avoid killing his father and marrying his mother. Oedipus flees from in the Sophocles play, he flees from who he thinks are his parents.
His adoptive parents.
He doesn't know he's adopted. Mm-hmm. So he flees from his parents to avoid ever doing this. And in the act of fleeing from the man he thinks is his father, he ends up running directly into a stranger on the road who he then murders, not aware that that man is his father. By the end of the play in Sophocles, it's just heartbreaking that not only have all these things the characters have tried to prevent come true, but that they could have been happier if they just hadn't known the truth. It's very, very complicated, this idea that knowing the truth of who you are can actually not set you free and make you happier, which is a kind of common modern idea, but can actually be something that destroys you. Because if you're married to your mother and have children with her but don't know that she's your mother, all you know is you have a loving relationship and you're happy, good parents, it's an interesting question as to whether or not you'd be better off just never finding out, or if in the final moments of your life you'd want to know this fact that then makes the whole rest of your life a kind of horrific tragedy.
This one thing that may be helpful in this regard is that the notion of tragic wisdom. At the time the plays are being written, there's a kind of quarrel going on between poets and philosophers. It's the time of Socrates. And you can look at the circumstance of this quarrel between poets. Actually, there are three combatants. It's tragedy, tragic poets, and then the comic poets, and then Socrates. The evidence for this, that there was viewed in that way, is that the tragedians wrote wrote a play about comedy. We have comic poets write a play about Socrates, and they're all taking shots at each other. We can probably come back in a minute.
We'll talk about that dialogue in a moment. My guests are David Davies from the University of Dallas and Kevin Moriarty from the Dallas Theater Center, which is producing Oedipus L. Ray. It will be open at the Wiley Theater through March 2nd. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
Listen, my sister, what about her?
She's not doing too good right now.
Her husband just died.
No, we don't have to know each other.
Just be cool around her, okay? Don't mention her old man.
What happened to him?
What did I just say? You respect me, right?
Give me a reason not to. Of course.
Just so we're clear.
Come right out.
She's not available.
I wouldn't do that.
She's hiding.
She on the run?
No, just mourning.
She religious?
No, but here we still believe things in this barrio. About what happens to us. Our fate. We're very old school here. We got our cell phones and our internet, but we also got our prophecy, prediction, and oracles. We follow the old traditions.
Yeah, I don't believe in all that stuff. It's kind of a prison.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard a scene from the Dallas Theater Center's production of Oedipus El Rey. In that scene, Oedipus and Creon met for the first time after Oedipus was released from prison. They had known each other from their time in the Youth Authority. And Creon is giving Oedipus a brief overview of how things work in the neighborhood. You heard Creon there played by Daniel Duque Estrada, who is a new member of the company at the Dallas Theater Center, and Oedipus is played by Philippe Bogan. My guests this hour are David Davies, who is a scholar at the University of Dallas of Classics and English, and Kevin Moriarty is artistic director at the Dallas Theater Center and director of this particular production of Oedipus El Rey. Before the break, you were talking, David, about this dialogue that was taking place among Socrates and comic poets and tragic poets. Please continue.
Yeah, it's the basic point is this, that there's a disagreement about what is the usefulness of wisdom for us, or what's the proper response to understanding something, and that it could be put very simply, whether one way to put it is the O of understanding when you understand something. Tragic wisdom is, oh no. Comic wisdom is, oh ho. And philosophic wisdom is, oh wow. And the question is which of the three is the wisest response to our understanding things about ourselves? It's a question that is about wisdom, but it's trying to say these three different views are trying to say, no, we're sharper about this than you are. Now that, I think, then in the issue with Oedipus is that the play in a certain sense is, as Aristotle says, is an imitation. In other words, if you understand the play, all of a sudden you'll see something about yourself. The question then is the tragedy's understanding of the thing that you see as horrible, right? Is that the wisdom? What's being talked about in these plays is what we are. And what we see in Oedipus is he's constantly trying to do something. He's trying to escape from what the gods say he is and create something himself. And in that very act, as Kevin was saying, he fulfills what his nature is. So that makes us uneasy. It means that something about our very nature is fulfilling itself in spite of our efforts to avoid it.
Well, and that takes us back nicely to the clip we just heard, because Oedipus is telling us, I don't believe in this nonsense. It's not for me. And yet he is unable to escape it, despite his confidence that he is maybe bigger than fate.
Yeah, it always strikes me that these plays, that this play specifically by Sophocles was written at the same time that democracy is being born into fruition in ancient Greece. And it strikes me that as a political philosophical system was coming about people having the power and the responsibility to make choices for their lives and their community, that at the same time there was this significant great art that was being made about the fact that no matter how much you attempt to make good, right choices, no matter how much you attempt to exercise free will, that there are limits on this. And that was clearly a vexing concern for the ancient Greeks. And in Luis Alfaro's play, I think we have to reconfront that in our own lives today. And we don't contextualize that with Greek gods, but that all of us have limits on us, which some people acknowledge the limits to the extent that it renders them powerless to make changes in their lives. They submit to those limits of economics or of religion or of human desire or psychology. Others attempt to deny that those limits exist and attempt to push past them, and still others run just head first into it and are thwarted by it.
Well, it speaks to an extraordinary, I don't know if you call it a cautious optimism that must have existed at the dawn of democracy, where many people say, well, it's probably pointless to try and do this thing, but let's do it anyway. There's this question of trying to do the right thing for its own sake, whether the outcome is guaranteed or even likely or not.
Right. Well, and in Oedipus El Rey, we meet a young teenage character who keeps saying, I want to make my own destiny. I don't want to be limited by history or by a past. I want to create something new. In his case, he wants to leave prison and rise to the top to be the king of a gang. And in doing that he's going to gain power and fulfillment and the love of a woman who he truly connects with at a really deep level. That's kind of the classic American story, and that's the great idea behind most of the democratic movements around the world. It's that idea that we can grab control of our destiny and not be limited by the past and truly make ourselves more free in the act of that, of pursuing something greater. But at the same time, Luis seems to be suggesting that it's not quite as simple as that, that there are forces out there that can make that search for something better a real challenge and perhaps put, for some people, a ceiling on it.
This, what you're saying now, Kevin, is I think the point at which the ancient play and the modern play come closest together in the following way. What struck me, I mentioned earlier about the unity of a day, you mm-hmm. know, to keep the thing. But in the modern play, if I remember correctly, the first line of the play is, I'm going to tell you a story. And there's emphasis on telling stories, whether they're truthful or not. At the very end of the play, once again, you return to someone saying something about stories. And now the assertion is that this is a story, and if I don't remember the lines exactly, but it's something like one must take control of the story and tell one's own story, right? In other words, making stories is viewed to making this a new story is the way to escape from the imprisonment of fate. Now, that is dead on, I think, in what Aristotle meant about in Sophocles being the most poetic. The only problem is that the modern play says that's the solution to escape from the determinism of economic circumstances or social circumstances. That's just what Oedipus is always doing. He's making a story about himself that he would like to believe about himself to escape from the horrible prophecy that he has been subject to by nature. And that's what fulfills his nature. In other words, in the ancient play, making stories about ourselves, making up versions of ourselves, is what is tragic and actually quite scary. It's a form of, shall we say, intellectual incest. Insofar as in our very nature, it is to generate things. That's what nature means, to grow. And what we do as human beings with our intellect is constantly make versions of ourselves, which we broadcast to everyone else as a way to congratulate ourselves on our importance or everything else. Right. And that is what the play shows us is very dangerous. Not more dangerous, it's terrifying.
Right. I think there's a real in Oedipus El Rey, I think Luis feels a real obligation to not end the play at the moment of deepest despair. So though the story ends in the same place that the myth does, with Oedipus having killed his father, married his mother, and now he is blinded and she is dead. So that's as depressing and tragic an ending as you can get in any definition of the word. But I think it's important for the modern play for Luis to have that chorus of prisoners step back in and ask a series of questions. And they don't state answers, but they do ask questions about what stories how we want to understand this story and what lessons we want to take from this and how we can take this story and potentially choose to change it in the choices that we make, in the lives that we live. And one way of doing that in literature and art and philosophy and politics is by telling the story as a cautionary tale, that we learn from the stories we tell, we understand ourselves from the stories we tell, and then that means we have the possibility to change the story itself. So in a really kind of practical social justice way, that might mean really thinking about what are the best ways that we deal with issues of justice and incarceration. It might be a real desire for us to understand our psychological natures, our deepest desires, our personality traits, so that we can then rise above them in the moments that we would be better served by doing that. It might be about really fully understanding and embracing a religious understanding that allows us to move forward with freedom and self-actualization and making the world a better place instead of just responding to tradition for tradition's sake. Those are possible kind of next steps that one could take away from looking at this ancient tragic story retold in a modern context. And I think that's the hope that Luis has, is that the audience will move to those places, deeply personal as well as political and spiritual, and say, well, what do we do with this story now?
Yeah, what I was trying to I don't mean to suggest in what I had said about the terror of making stories to be a criticism of what Luis is doing. What I was suggesting is that what Sophocles was attempting to do was to raise a powerful question about his own activity as a poet. I mean, if you think about what poets do and what we love them, they have these skills with the rhythms of words and all these things. And what they do is, in speech, create things which then shape our understanding of ourselves. And they, by the way, Aristotle, another way to understand this is Aristotle's understanding of imitation in the Poetics is to say, this is how we understand ourselves philosophically. We do it by making versions and then examining their accuracy to, you know, our own circumstance. What tragedy looks at in that activity and says, this is scary, because it's almost as if we believe that we generate ourselves. Now, if you think about that in terms of incest, let's talk about the nasty
business.
Let's
talk about it. Well, I have a question about that. So finish your point, and then I have a question.
Okay. The incest. What is incest really? Incest is when there is you violate the notion that there is one woman who is not like all other women, because she's your mother.
That's a really interesting point. It's never occurred to me, but
no, me either. Yeah.
And the same thing holds with patricide, mm-hmm. right? What's the horror of patricide? Is you're killing a man, you know, given that men are men and they get into tangles, but you're killing in other words, these are two markers that say that there is something higher than just the natural woman which, if I'm a man, I used that to procreate with, and if it's a man, he's a possible adversary. But what happens is that that marker is what's violated by incest. And it what it means then, if you break such markers, then we're left with just our nature with no restraints, and that's really scary.
Scary and essential. I mean, that's, I think, the great thing about art, about philosophy, about being human, is that the more over thousands of years, the more that we try to understand who we are as individuals or as a species, the more we try to understand what it is that comprises the limits on our world and break through them, the more we also are endlessly confronted with the fact that that has consequence, unintended consequences that ultimately in all of our lives result in death, since that's the destiny of all of us on Earth. But at the same time, we also have this impulse that's embedded in us as humans that's different than animals who of course don't have free will and who don't make choices in the act of a day about what they eat or who they love or why they do those things. So I think there's embedded in us as humans this desire to know ourselves, know our world, and make it better, to beat the system in some way. And there also, at least thus far in human history, we all hit those moments where, despite the best intention, there are limits to what we can truly know or control about ourselves, our relationships with others, or the world in which we live. But I don't think that the lesson necessarily is to stop the attempt. It just might mean that attempt is noble but tragic.
We're speaking this hour with Kevin Moriarty of the Dallas Theater Center, which is staging the play Oedipus L. Ray through March 2nd at the Wiley Theater. Also with us is David Davies, who is Assistant Professor of English and Adjunct Professor of Classics at the University of Dallas. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David Davies is here with us from the University of Dallas, where he's Assistant Professor of English and Adjunct Professor of Classics. Kevin Moriarty joins us as well. He is Artistic Director at the Dallas Theater Center and Director of Oedipus L. Ray, which is open through March 2nd at the Wiley Theater. If you'd like to join the conversation about Oedipus, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Kevin, based on what David was saying, the relationship between Jocasta and Oedipus for the original audience might have meant something different than it means today. But for me today, it seems like it's an amazing metaphor, this separation of Jocasta and Oedipus at birth and the sort of pain that causes her as she thinks about it every day, and this reunion that fulfills something. It speaks to the shattering of families, and there's poverty, and there's more than a suggestion of domestic violence in your version of this story. Can you talk about how you wanted to frame that? I mean, the taboo of incest is so hard for us to get over, and yet we have to feel sympathetic toward these characters for the story to work, and we have to feel sympathetic when we think of them as lovers and also when we think of them as mother and son.
It interestingly enough, when I first read Oedipus L. Ray, Luis's play, the moment that I fell in love with it and knew that absolutely certainly I was going to find a way to direct this play on stage at the Wiley Theater was the central scene in the middle of the play where Oedipus and Jocasta meet for the first time since the moment he was born and ripped out of her arms. And it is a scene that is written with such deep, deep connection of two people who are so damaged that they only are half alive or only know half of themselves. And over the course of this stunning scene, they start to fill in the spaces for each other. They start to provide a sense of hope and opportunity and healing and connection that ultimately results in them making love, disrobing, touching each other, kissing, and making love. And, you know, whenever I would – I'm certainly not – you know, Dallas Theater Center's official position is not in favor of incest. And in any normal
– Thank you for that disclaimer.
In any normal circumstance
–
Right, exactly. In any normal circumstance, I would be kind of horrified by a scene like that. And I would – as I was watching it or reading it or directing it, I would be recoiling and going, don't do it, don't do it. Just like in a horror film where you think, you know, don't open that closet door
that the
killer's
behind. It's like watching the Zapruder film.
Exactly. But in this scene, at least for me and for most of the audiences who've seen the play thus far, it's actually not a scene where your response is revulsion or stop, stop, don't come together. The opposite happens. I think for most audience members, they start to feel like there's a real possibility for salvation and healing and hope in these two characters coming together because they fill the spaces that have been missing in each other's lives. And that is, of course, tragic, and that is, of course, deeply, deeply sad and problematic. But it also speaks to, I think, something really, really human about this idea that there are parts of us that are damaged, and if only there was someone who could share that and fit with that and understand that, that it could potentially make us whole. It doesn't work out so well in this play, but it's still an oddly beautiful vision rather than a kind of freak show of, you know, bad luck horror stories.
And later, when they have both realized what's happened between them and who each other is, there's this devastating moment where Oedipus says, "Mama," I have goosebumps just thinking about it now because. Again, it's not only that this thing that we all recoil at has happened, but it's that everything, every moment of joy now has been poisoned. You can't even think that this was a thing that in its own moment was okay.
Yeah, right near the end of the play, Oedipus says to Jocasta as he is about to be blinded, and he says, let me blind myself, let me never see you again, and let me live in a memory without pain. And that is at once just heartbreakingly sad and also, at least for me, very beautiful. The idea as one approaches the end of life of being able to retreat from the world with all of its joys but also all of its intense challenges, to be able to retreat into oneself, into a memory without pain is, I think, a kind of desire that many people have as they look at their final moments. Mm. And so I think that's a very, very, very complicated part of the play. And I think it's real heart and soul. And that is a big difference from Sophocles, where we get only a sense in Sophocles that Oedipus and Jocasta have been happily married. They've been married in Sophocles. They've been married for quite a long time. They have four children, two sons and two daughters. They're strong, compelling, powerful rulers. In Oedipus El Rey, you feel like, oh, these two damaged people have found someone who with whom they can build a life and become something better than they would be alone, only to have that almost immediately ripped away from them and left with nothing other than hoping to be able to hold on to a single moment of a memory without pain.
It was funny that portion of the play, the middle of the play, where you have this almost romantic, as a way of describing their meeting, was the point at which, given my background as a classicist, that I had the greatest difficulty because I was trying to push it away or say, well, that's not what Sophocles said, but just trying to understand what is the understanding behind the play such that you would choose to do something which in Sophocles, I mean, if you're going to draw upon the play, but in Sophocles, it's really not romantic at all. I mean, he becomes
Like a marriage of convenience or a marriage of
It's really a marriage
power.
Of convenience. That's the only way it's presented in the play. It's because when he arrives there, Jocasta has lost her husband, and this is the royal household. So, of course, in having performed the office of a king, which they accord to him because of his solving the riddle of the Sphinx, the wife comes with it. And it's never presented in any other way than that. In fact, I think that romantic notion really doesn't belong, at least in the classical plays. It's not really what's operating.
It definitely doesn't belong in Sophocles, and I think that's the thing that is most unique in Luis's play, even more than the political ideas. I think are essential to the understanding of the potential for change and hope in the play. But I think it's this central romantic relationship, which is obviously a sexualized relationship. They of course make love, and that is important for the tragedy to function. But it's really, I think, portrayed at a deeper romantic level, a human level of deep, deep, deep longing and connection. And I think that notion comes back to the fact that all of us at some level want to be whole. And that the ability to integrate the parts of yourself that need completion or healing to become more whole, I think is something that is a human quest. And so for Jocasta, who is held back by a sense of powerlessness, and then Oedipus, who is held back by his overly determined violent nature to get ahead, for instance, or her connection to faith and his complete lack of any of that, that when you look at those elements, just like young and old or mother and son or male and female, that those pieces fit together and kind of create one whole person.
Well, I guess that also speaks to the fact that we simply don't conceive of a good marriage anymore as simply being a partnership for economic and pragmatic reasons. And for, you know, a very long time in human history, if you fell in love with the person you were married to, that was a bonus, but certainly not something that most people ever expected.
That's right. Going back to your point about the wrenching realization when he realizes who this person is, what I think is really remarkable about in the modern play is, and you're feeling that is testimony to the seriousness of these boundaries that are not natural but are deeply held conventions which separate us. I mean, for instance, Kevin, your observation about what when Aristotle defines human being, he gives three different definitions of it. Of human being. He says it's a rational animal, he says political animal in the politics, and he says most imitative animal in the poetics. You put those three things together and you have to try to somehow understand, I think they have to be seen together, to see what it's a kind of philosophical version of what we are. Now, that results in something that distinguishes us from other living creatures, which is what you're testifying to when you say, I feel the wrenching that this one realization, that's my mother, that's not my wife, that one thing wrenches you out of the animal and brings you into human being.
Hmm.
And that's where... I mean, in spite of all the differences in the plays, that the plays are producing at the most fundamental level something that, you know, is trying to imitate what we are.
So these days we go to the theater, we seek out art to make us question things and have ideas. Sometimes we simply go for entertainment purposes. I know for the Greeks this was an element of religious observance or celebration, or how was theater used by the ancient Greeks?
Well, let me...
Feel free to say that's completely wrong.
No. For a number of years, I took tours of students and some adults over, you know, in the Mediterranean, took them around, especially places like Sicily. Sicily is a good example because the remains are so extraordinary. The climate leads to their preservation. And I saw all these little towns that were formed you know, that existed along the coast. And when I was there, this was in 98, they were just beginning an excavation in a town up in the hills called Morgantina. And the strange thing about this town was that it was being developed and all of a sudden development stopped. And it was discovered and they're bringing it back. Now, what was the one of the first things that they built? They built a theater. Now, the theaters functioned, yes, they had a religious origin, but you have to say that the Greeks were, there is the civic religion. You don't have a personal religion. You do have some kind of understanding of your ancestors or have some relation. But it's the religion is really is civic.
When you mean civic, what do you mean?
What I mean is that it is there are certain things that identify you as you're an Athenian. Mm-hmm. So you perform sacrifices on a yearly basis at these temples. These temples are, I mean, by the time you get to the Parthenon and the frieze around the Parthenon, I mean, that frieze, which is in the British Museum, it used to, those friezes in other temples show the gods in various scenes in their life. What did the Athenians do? They put themselves there. It's the procession up to in the Panathenaic Games. So the religious aspect is dropping out. But at the same time, the plays are examining those deepest things that we honor and need to respect. So in a certain sense, if you want to call that religion, it's ongoing. I don't know whether that helps with the question.
And I think it's fascinating that from those earliest days of great human philosophy and art and democracy, that there's this impulse to represent our human condition outside of ourselves as a work of art, to look at it, whether in images or in stories, in epic poems or on stage. And there's an impulse to come together to experience that, that you want the community to come together, have this shared story, looking at representations of our own lives in some way with the hope, I guess, that in doing that, some deeper level of understanding happens, which allows us in some way in one of those aspects of being human to advance.
Kevin Moriarty is Artistic Director at the Dallas Theater Center and Director of Oedipus El Rey, which runs through March 2nd at the Wiley Theater. David Davies is Assistant Professor of English and Adjunct Professor of Classics at the University of Dallas. David and Kevin, thank you so much for being here. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
Thank
it.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.